Hey, sci-fi fans, this is Ira Stephen Baer, showrunner on Star Trek Deep Space Nine and producer-director on the upcoming DS9 documentary, What We Left Behind. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, all you fans of superhero, sci-fi, comic books, pop culture, and all things just amazing and cool. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Another big anniversary we're going to be celebrating today. 25 years of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. That's right, the show premiered January 1993. Today, I will be sitting down with the man behind the series. He was a writer-producer for the first couple of seasons. He took over as showrunner in season three all the way through the incredible finale. He has got a new documentary on the horizon looking back at a quarter century of Deep Space Nine. Ira Stephen Baer will be joining me in just a few moments. Man, we're going to have a lot of fun talking about Trek, talking about so much more today with Ira. It's going to be a good episode. Now, for you Deep Space Nine fans out there, if you're just checking out Comic Book Central for the first time, because you saw that Ira was my special guest today. First, welcome to Comic Book Central. Glad to have you hanging out here in the lair. After you listen to today's show, you're probably going to want to go back and check out my other Deep Space Nine conversations with the cast. Episode 56, Terry Farrell and Michael Dorn. Episode 124, Renee Auberjonois. 125, Nana Visitor, she was here. 197, Alexander Siddig, also talked about Gotham with him too. That was a lot of fun. So a lot of Deep Space Nine goodness just waiting for you out there. And a lot of ways you can catch up with the show. The easiest way is to subscribe to the show on iTunes. There's a link to the show on iTunes at my website, comicbookcentral.net. You can also follow the show on social media with some of the links there at comicbookcentral.net. Also at the website, each and every episode is in the archive for streaming and downloading, so you can get all the episodes that way. Blueberry, Stitcher, Google Play, they're all out there. And a new platform for Comic Book Central this season. You can catch up with the show at Blog Talk Radio. It's blogtalkradio.com. Be sure to check out all of the Comic Book Central interviews there. And you can also find a ton of very cool podcasts from some very cool people out there as well. So Blog Talk Radio, you're going to want to check that out as well. All right, we have got a silver anniversary to celebrate. First, check this out. Then I will be right back to talk Trek and so much more with Ira Stephen Baer. Born and raised in the Bronx, Ira graduated Lehman College in New York City, studied communications and theater, and was offered a scholarship in Massachusetts, but instead headed for the West Coast to pursue a career in Hollywood, eventually writing for TV shows like Brett Maverick, Bring Him Back Alive, and Fame. In 1990, he beamed on board the Starship Enterprise as a writer-producer for the third season of Star Trek The Next Generation, where he worked on one of the show's most memorable episodes, Yesterday's Enterprise. And he gave Patrick Stewart's Captain Jean-Luc Picard a much-needed break in the episode Captain's Holiday. Now, Ira left the world of Star Trek behind at the end of Season 3, or so he thought. Just a few years later, Trek writer-producer Michael Piller convinced him to return to the 24th century for a brand new series, Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Beyond the boundaries of charted space, where a dark, mysterious world waits on the threshold of new discovery. Prepare yourself for an adventure beyond imagination. Prepare for the thrilling two-hour world premiere of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Ira and the DS9 writers broke all the Trek rules by crafting tales full of interpersonal conflict, serialized storytelling, morally ambiguous characters, and tackling the horrors of an all-out war. After seven seasons of DS9, Ira went on to work on shows like Dark Angel, The Twilight Zone, The 4400, and Alphas, and films like last year's Lucky, featuring screen legend Harry Dean Stanton in one of his final performances. Ira's currently hard at work with the team behind numerous Trek documentaries. They're producing a documentary on, of course, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, called What We Left Behind, which last year, during a crowdfunding campaign, raised over $600,000 from fans who want to go back and revisit the beloved crew from our favorite space station. Now, my guest today, he is a writer, producer, director. He has secured his place in the half-century legacy that is Star Trek. His most recent project is a documentary looking back at his series, Deep Space Nine. A big welcome to Ira Stephen Bear. Ira, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Happy to be here, Joe.
Happy to have you here, and happy anniversary, my friend. Happy 25th anniversary. Boy, can you believe it's been 25 years?
Seriously, I cannot, but everyone tells me it's true, so I will believe them.
I saw you tweet it out on the anniversary date. I believe a lot of people were tweeting it out on the anniversary date. There's a lot going on with Deep Space Nine. We're going to be talking a lot about this. First of all, the documentary. Congratulations on the success of the crowdfunding campaign. That was almost a year ago, I think, as we were recording this, right?
Pretty much.
Okay. Tell our listeners, so for those that aren't familiar with this, we've got a documentary coming up. Take us back like maybe a year and just sort of tell us what happened and how this may have changed the documentary a little bit, because we're still waiting on it. We're eager anticipation.
I believe we're all in that same situation.
You too. You're waiting to see it, right?
Well, for me, it started in 2012. So, I mean, we could go back a year, but a year doesn't do it justice.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to talk a lot about it, but I just this past year, I think, it really amped up what you were going to do with it, correct? I mean, I think it was originally going to be like a 60-minute documentary.
It was going to be a small doc with, you know, a couple of interviews or as many interviews as we could get at a convention or two. And it would be, you know, it would be a nice look back at the middle child of the Star Trek franchise. What happened was we did this Indiegogo campaign in which we were asking for, I believe, was $150,000 in order to get a score, music score written, to be doing some interstitial animation at the time, things like that, and also to do some clips of the show finally in high def.
And that's the big expense right there, isn't it? Because you could have somebody talking about it, about a clip or a scene, but to be able to go to that scene and show it, that costs money.
Costs a lot of money.
Yeah,
it costs more money than I thought it was going to cost.
And you're the and guy; so, you're the boss on it.
So the $150,000, you know, Dave Zappone, who's, you know, producing this and co-directing it with me, and who's done a bunch of Star Trek documentaries, I said, well, are we going to make 150? Why'd you grab 150 out of the thin air? Why are we asking for that amount? And he said, well, that I think we can do that in 30 days. You know, I think we can make that. We don't want to put up a goal that we can't reach. And I think we can do that. I think we can make 150 in 30 days. I thought, okay. Makes sense. I don't know about this end of the business. So I said, sure. And we made $150,000, I think, in the first day,
That's crazy. That's so crazy.
So it's like, okay, so someone underestimated the power of Deep Space Nine, yeah. Clearly.
Yeah.
And we wound up with $660,000-some-odd, which, you know, is fantastic. And we were very happy, and we got to film some little fundraising clips with some of the actors, which was a lot of fun. So we thought we were really sitting fat. And then, of course, once you start talking about HD, it starts getting a little scary money-wise. But CBS has been very helpful with this doc. So hopefully that's all going to work out just fine.
But how does that make you feel? Because you refer to it, the middle child. I think you've even heard it. I think you've even referred to it as the, you know, the stepchild, you know, in the past. Is this the Rodney Dangerfield of the Star Trek franchise and never got any respect? But, I mean, how did that make you feel when you saw all of a sudden this series that maybe didn't get the respect it deserved when it was on? All of a sudden, people are giving you money because they want to relive this. They want to go back and take another look at it.
I think the intensity of the fan response, not just in terms of dollars, but just in terms of their goodwill, was very encouraging. Let's put it that way. And certainly was better than a kick in the head. So I would say that, but you know, it's been a journey, Joe. It's been a journey that literally began in 2012, you know. So it's been a hell of a ride. You know, I've never done a doc before. I've been interviewed for plenty, but I've never been, you know, acting as the interviewer, the host, whatever you want to call it. So it's a whole different thing. But, you know, when Dave came to me in 2012, I had not been to a convention in 13 years or so. And, you know, I was very, very thankful and look back at my years on Deep Space Nine as a terrific time. But I knew a lot of people who I still saw, you know, cast and crew and people I was still friends with, but I hadn't really thought about the show in any really substantial way for a long time. So I was already surprised when I went to the conventions, back to the conventions, at the fan response there. I was blown away.
Yeah, this was going back to, it was kind of leading up to the 20th anniversary, I think, at the time, right?
Yeah, well, what happened was I had been saying to Dave ever since I knew him, you know, the one person I wanted to see, the one person who fascinated me endlessly and I had not had any contact with in 13, 14 years was Avery Brooks. Avery Brooks has never failed, has never stopped, you know, fascinating me just on all levels. And I thought, you know, I got to see, I just kept wondering, why would it be if I ever ran into Avery again after all these years? Why would his response be, you never know with Avery? You know, and he said, well, come to the convention and, you know, it'll be a good thing and you'll find out he's going to be there. So that's where I went. I went to see Avery and, you know, it was a hell of a reunion. It was very emotional. He hugged me way longer than I expected him to. And I think everyone started to get a little uncomfortable. He just, we had a strong bonding moment. Let's put it that way.
He seems like a guy who is all in on every, no matter what he's doing, he's all in on whatever that is. Is that about right?
Yeah, I would say he's all in or he's all out.
Yeah. Documentary so far, he's all out, right? I mean, he's,
well,
have you gotten him for the doc?
All out. We've spoken to him about it.
Yeah.
We've talked to him. Dave's in contact with him quite a bit.
Yeah.
Avery feels strongly that he has said everything he needs to say. He was interviewed. He did the captains. Then he did the captain's closer look. He doesn't feel like he's going to bring anything to the table. He's said a couple of things to us that we've taken very seriously in terms of widening the amount of people we were talking to. In terms of finding things to do, so the documentary is not going to be quite your traditional talking heads documentary. Obviously, we've done 100 hours of interviews, so there'll be plenty of talking heads, but there's going to be a lot of other things besides that. And so, you know, I have his voice in my head, you know.
He'll be in. I'm sure you're going to get him. I'm sure you'll get him in. It would be unbelievable if he doesn't take part in it.
But you know, he's in the doc.
Yeah. You got like
in the doc. We have plenty of footage, archival. Plenty of interviews, at the convention just from a few years ago.
Yeah.
So Avery's point of view will come across when necessary. But you know, it's. He is my captain, as I say over and over again. He is my captain, and I support him when he does something that I agree with. I support him when he makes a decision I don't agree with, but that doesn't matter. I support him either way.
One of the coolest things I thought about this documentary, and I don't know if it was inspired by his comment to sort of go beyond the Talking Heads thing, but you get all the writers, the DS9 writers in a room, and you guys basically break down it as if you were going to work on a Monday to go to work on the eighth season, right?
Well, that was the idea I had after talking to Avery and having that, you know, I wanted something, I really wanted to give the fans, and this is before the Indiegogo campaign, I wanted to give the fans something really unique and something special. And, you know, it just seemed like, what the hey, let's get the band together. You know, it's not really the way it's normally done, because one of the things I said to them was, we're going to have no discussion ahead of time. You know, we're not going to kind of come up with an idea so that when we get before the cameras, we'll already have something in our heads, you know, agreed upon. It's going to be as cold as ice going in there, and we're just going to see what's going to happen. Now, obviously, when you're working every day on a TV show and having lunch together, you're talking about upcoming episodes all the time. So we would have had some pre-talk about this, but I didn't want to do it because it would not have been fair. It would have seemed artificial. Mm-hmm. All I said was either watch the final episode or read the Wikipedia or one of the sites so everyone remembers what the last episode was about and where all the characters ended up, because none of us could, everyone had their own ideas how the show ended at the time.
We're going back a ways.
So
yeah.
We all went back and looked at that. And then when we came in, we had one day, which is again, you know, we got through this story and, you know, there was a comic book company that wanted to turn it into a graphic novel. I said, absolutely not.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about that. I wanted to ask you about that because I was kind of wondering if like that, if like we, okay, let me just back up 1 second. The question I have for you then is how real was this? Because I know when you get, look, it's all fun and games and everything's fine and this is cute and we're going to put a documentary together and we're going to put on a show. But when creative minds get in a room, especially the minds that you brought together, sometimes some real stuff happens. How real is this?
Well, the breaking the story is totally real.
Okay.
I mean, the fact that we were all together in the room, all of us at the same time, hadn't happened in forever. So,
right.
I mean, all of it was real.
But did you get a story? Did you get a story?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
We did, because, you know, it
you know where I'm going with this.
What?
You know where I'm going with this. That, look, we all want to see the documentary, but we all love us some Deep Space Nine. Is there a story to be told?
Yeah, but there's a story for that day. That's
okay.
What I'm saying.
Okay.
If we had a second day, we'd do what we've done with every single story we ever broke for Deep Space
Nine.
Will you
make a second day? Okay, will you do that?
We'd go back and we'd look it over and we'd say, you know, we could do better here. We could do better here.
Yeah.
What about this? Does Quark have enough to do? Does so-and-so have enough to do? So we would look back and you know, do a rewrite of the story as
right.
We're sitting there. But what I wanted to do, because I knew it was the only way to do it, was we would have one frickin' day to get everyone together, and it's going to be the best we could do on that day. It's a story and it's finished,
yeah.
You know, but would I want it to be put in between the pages of a comic book or between the pages of a graphic novel? No, because
okay.
I would think that if we had more time, you know, we'd make it better.
Right.
But it was certainly a great day. I mean, everyone had the time of their lives. It was just like no screwed, you know, 23 years or whatever it was at the time. It took a little while,
yeah.
But it got to the point where Renee Echevarria kept going, like, wait a second. You know, this is all make-believe, right? We're not really, the show's never going to get made. At one point, someone, I don't know who it was, someone said, well, look, if we do that, then come episode 6, how are we going?
That's what I wanted to hear.
Am I losing my mind?
Yeah.
Am I losing my mind?
Yeah.
There is no episode 6. There is no episode 1.
Oh, well.
Like, Renee, didn't you get the memo? We're doing this as if, like, it's really going to happen today. Today, we have to believe that it's really going to happen. Tomorrow, we could all laugh about it. But today, you got to believe.
Okay.
Today, you got to believe there's an episode one. You got to believe there's an episode six. You got to believe, I suppose, there's an episode 18 down the line.
But see, whoever that person was that said episode six, I don't think they were faking for the cameras. I think they probably thought we could do this. So
Because you don't want to put out a crappy story, you know.
I guess the question I'm asking you, I guess I'll get right to the question. Is it possible that this could be a CBS streaming on demand movie?
No.
All right. Fair enough.
No.
I had to ask that question.
Here's the thing. I want to believe is that this documentary will get the show remastered in HD. That's what I want. It's what I've wanted since the beginning. I've never been happy with the DVDs.
Yeah.
Even back in the day, I thought they were a little muddy, especially the early seasons. I have not watched, with the exception of the pilot after Michael Piller passed away, I have not watched a complete episode of Deep Space Nine except for the pilot since the show went off the air, because I said I'm not watching it until it gets remastered. And little did I know that I'd be waiting so long, especially doing this documentary when we're talking to people about so many episodes, and they go, Jesus, I'd like to sit down and watch that episode, you know?
And they're so good.
Not going to do it.
Little mini movies. I mean, look, we'll get into it. We're gonna take it apart. But let's go back in time a little bit. That was your biggest experience with Star Trek. I want to go back a little bit though to talk about your first experience with Star Trek. It was with Kirk and Company, right?
With Kirk and Company.
Yeah.
I mean, as a viewer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a kid. Okay. Yeah. You watched Star Trek when it was first on.
I certainly did with my sister.
Right. Okay. Young Ira's opinion of Star Trek when he was watching it as a kid.
Okay. As a kid, it was the main thing was my sister and I really dug it. None of my other friends were into the show at all. They, you know, we shared The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Wild Wild West and, all kinds of shows. But no one seemed to care about Star Trek except for my sister and myself. So it seemed special for that reason, you know. Also, I remember that one day my sister said to me, she goes, I was saying something about Kirk this, Kirk that, and my sister, who's older than I am by a couple of years, said, you should be watching Spock. I said, what? She said, watch Spock. Watch what Leonard Nimoy is doing. You want to watch acting, watch what Leonard Nimoy is doing.
Wow.
He's doing very little, but he's really doing quite a lot. And that was the first kind of, you know, made me think about what's behind the obvious, you know? It's like you watch something, but it's what are you really watching? What's behind the surface of things? I started to think about it. And that's how I got into thinking about acting, about you could do the same thing with writing, you could do it with TV shows. You start deconstructing things. You think about it more than just plot, more than just, you know, the easy stuff. Do I like it? Is it good? Is it bad? Too simplistic. You got to dig deeper to really understand what are they saying? What's the show really about? All that stemmed from Star Trek in a way. Then a few years later, as I got older, it went into a whole bunch of other things. But I will say this. I remember strongly the disappointment we felt in season three. It's season three. I know there were some strong episodes, but we really felt the show had gone down.
Which one did you in?
You know, I mean, there's a lot of shows.
Spock's Brain?
Just to make episodes.
Spock's Brain?
Yeah, well, now I love Spock's Brain.
Okay, all right.
Spock's Brain I can watch all the time. It's like, that's an Ed Wood episode. But I have to say, when the show went off the air, I was not disappointed.
All right.
You know?
No, it's interesting. it's interesting because I kind of like with writers and producers, I always kind of want to get like the nuts and bolts. Like what made you start thinking of that? And so that really taught you story structure and motivation, character motivation, those types of things, right?
Yeah, it certainly taught me about, yes, all that stuff, and also about acting and what made, you know, different types of acting. I think, you know, the great thing was you had Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and not only were they great characters with great interactions, but they were all portrayed very differently by the actors. And that was something to realize. And it also just like simple things, Joe, about types, the type, the emotional humanistic one, the colder, you know, more, you know, the brainiac. You start breaking it down a little more. And where do they differ, which is easy, where they differ, but where do they also, you know, come together? And the other thing it also did, which wasn't the only show, but I grew up in the Bronx with a lot of friends. Very, you know, the Bronx was not a place for weakness. You know, there was it was tough to be hanging out on the schoolyard and on the streets of the Bronx. You had to have a hard skin because people, you know, there was not a lot of kindness, even in your best friends. It was like kill or be killed. But I thought the relationship between those guys, the friendship between those three guys, I thought was very cool.
Yeah.
You know?
No,
that meant a lot to me.
It's interesting to see that as an inspiration. Well, yeah, and then you learn how each character can support another one, and that basically takes you to stories instead of just having one guy. Friend,
as opposed to having friends who, you know, let you down all the time and who you let down, you know. The loyalty thing was not always all that strong in streets and in the schoolyard.
But you could live it out on the page.
Yeah.
So then, okay, so you moved to L.A. Was your original thought to do comedies?
Yeah, that was the idea. I mean, I had studied playwriting. I had gotten a scholarship to Brandeis University, which I, at the last minute, did not attend because the guy who got me the scholarship left. And so I decided not to do that. And I didn't want to become an academic, which is what I was afraid would happen if I went for my master's in playwriting. So, and also I had been working as a production assistant on a play, which Diane Keaton was the star, and someone stole her boots out of her dressing room in the company refused to pay for the boots, and I thought, boy, that's pretty cheap. You know, it's like I'm going to show business where there's money, where there's rivers of gold, and everyone has a pool. So, you know, so yeah, but I came out thinking I was going to do comedy. That's what I really wanted to do. I always try to put humor into all my scripts wherever I can. But you know what they say? It's like sometimes your dream comes true, but not in the way you think it's going to.
Yeah, because you got into a lot of dramas. There's one show in particular, before we talk Trek, I want to ask you about. Look, we love our comic books here at Comic Book Central. Tell me a little bit about Once a Hero.
Once a Hero. Once a Hero. In an alternate universe, Once a Hero was a huge success and lasted like a decade. But that's not this world. What happened, it was a very, 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 very ambitious idea, which the network at the time was not totally committed to. And it was about a comic book hero, Captain Justice, who comes to our reality where he loses his powers. And so he has to fight crime and do the right thing without his powers. But there's also the comic book, it wasn't really a comic book universe. It was really the universe of fiction, imagination. So there were all kind of characters we could play with. If the show would have lasted, I think we would have spent more time, as much time back there as here. But it was, Robert Forster, who's a terrific actor. He was the co-star. He played this character known as Gumshoe, who was like a Sam Spade character. But we had trouble casting the role. The first actor got dinged after the pilot and had to get reshot and everything. It's one of those shows that could not catch a break. But the central idea was just really funny. And some of the episodes that never aired had some really interesting concepts. And the show I was writing, the episode I was writing when we were canceled, which was going to be the first show that really took place in the so-called comic book universe, was pretty hilarious, where the writer who created Captain Justice goes over to that universe, that reality, where he's treated like a god. Oh. And so all the crime solving we could avoid, and it started to become more character driven and some really interesting things. I went into a meeting at ABC before we premiered, and on their big board where they had the entire schedule for the fall season, this is before we premiered, our block was empty.
Oh.
So that, you don't go feeling a great deal of confidence.
No.
When you see that the network is not exactly
committed.
But that was the show that you could actually say was totally ahead of its time.
So that begs the question, could it work today in this superhero environment where everything's a superhero show?
Yeah, we thought of that, you know, Dusty Kay, who created it. We've talked about that. It's just like, you know, I feel about superheroes, Joe, a little bit like I feel about zombies. You know, it's like too much.
Yeah.
It's like, don't ask me to do something with zombies and superheroes. At this stage of the game, they're everywhere, and I don't know. It doesn't exactly call to me.
No, I understand. Yeah, it seems like that would be something that would work. It was an interesting thought I saw online. It said many ABC stations, I don't know how true this is, many ABC stations preempted the show's first episode with Star Trek The Next Generation, which they correctly decided would be more successful. Well, okay, so that takes me right in. How did the world of Star Trek come back into your life?
Well, somehow, good question, how. I think someone read something at Paramount of mine that was an idea for a pilot that never went or something. I don't know what it was, but I was asked to come in to meet with Maurice Hurley in season two, at the start of season two, to come on the show then. And I had a meeting right here where we are now in Paramount at the you know, the lunchroom, and which was kind of cool. Like to be on that lot. I don't think I've been on that lot yet. And met with Maurice. We started talking, and I started asking him questions, and he started giving me answers about how the show worked and how the show was run and the role of the writer, producer in the show. And at the end of the lunch, I said, okay, Maurice, I'm not going to do this series. It sounds horrible. It sounds, there were so many things going on back. I mean, Dave Zappone, if you saw Chaos on the Bridge, the documentary, I mean, a lot of that was going on, you know.
So there were red flags already for you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I said, no. I said, thanks for lunch. All good. Called my sister up. I said, hey, you're not going to believe this, but I had a chance to go on Star Trek, and I turned them down. And she said, oh, well, you know, that's weird. And so I kind of forgot about that. Then the next year, Michael Piller had taken over as the showrunner, and I knew Michael for about 7 years already. And I liked him a lot. And some of the writers I had worked with on Fame, which was a show I did for 3 years, were also on the show now. So it was like, oh, okay. I'll give it a shot. So I came on board, hadn't really watched TNG, so I was really behind the curve, but Michael had a lot of trust in me, and I remember my first day on the show, he said, okay, rewrite act three of this episode. But what? I haven't even sat down in my office. Write act three. It's like, holy Jesus. So I'm reading the episode, and it's like, luckily, thank God, the only thing that was good was it was one of those run and jump episodes. So Act 3 basically was all action with not a lot of character dialogue, so I didn't have to worry too much of how well I knew the characters. But I was, like, lost. I was going to the other writers, and it's like, I got, like, a couple hours. What do I do? And everyone was in their own hell at that point, so they all...
And no Google at the time. Friends. You couldn't Google anything at the time.
So, you know, but I wrote something, and Michael liked it a lot. And, you know, we did that season, and at the end of that season, I said goodbye because I had a not great experience with the show. I kind of clashed a little bit with Gene Roddenberry. Not clashed, but I got schooled by Gene. And it was
this the John Wayne thing?
Yeah, the John Wayne. It was a whole story about, you know, I wanted to do an episode about Picard and his fears of aging and being no longer a captain, but being up to an admiral, and what would happen. And, you know, he goes on this pleasure planet and he does basically a holodeck where number one is, you know, Riker is now the captain and he has to gracefully step aside. And it was a really character driven thing. And, you know, the writers were really excited and it was, you know, we felt really good about it. And I was really proud of it. And, got the call that Gene wanted to see me, and Gene was not a happy camper. He said, Picard has no fears. He's not a 20th century person. He's a 24th century person. He has no inner conflicts. They told him to be an admiral. He'd say, absolutely, yes, sir. I'm fine with that. And, you know, yada, 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 yada. John Wayne... Picard is John Wayne. I said, well, John Wayne in his best movies had plenty of self-doubts and fears and angers. And certainly, you know, he was a complex character in a bunch of his movies. And it's, not that John Wayne, you know, the John Wayne that we all know. Anyway, it was not pleasant. And he said, the only thing I like is the pleasure planet. Do an episode about Picard getting
a date. Picard got to date. We'll keep it at that.
and then he started getting into it, and he was telling me that he wanted to see a lot of things in the background of people making love in various permutations. And I'm sitting there going, is he kidding me? Are we going to get this? Are they going to film this? Will they air this? I mean, he was asking for some pretty heavy-duty, kinky things. And it's like, so I'm still blown away that he didn't like the episode idea, the story. And now I'm looking at doing this kind of sexually out there episode that has no chance of airing on regular television. Some of the stuff, I guess, would be okay now, I guess, as background stuff. But I was, you know, and I said to Rick, I said, what? And Rick said, oh, don't worry. Just make sure that the Picard gets blank. And
a date.
Yeah,
he gets
a date.
So
I went back. And very, very, very reluctantly wrote this episode that became this kind of romp. And Picard fell in love and all that stuff. And that was that. And, you know, then I had another big fight over Ron and I did a rewrite on the episode Sarek about Spock's father coming to the station. And we were told, you know, we were doing this mind meld with the dad and with Picard and the dad. And at one point, I wanted Picard to say Spock. And I was told, can't say Spock. What do you mean? You can't say the word Spock? Nope, we're not talking about the original series anymore. I said, well, we have Spock's father. You know, so it's kind of, that's blown already. But no, can't say Spock, can reference Spock. So it took me 2 weeks, 2 weeks of arguing back and forth at various times to get permission to say the word Spock.
Which is crazy because they had DeForest Kelly in the opening in the pilot.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. So, you know, so there were things. And,
no, that's, it's fair. That's total fair. I mean, it's, you know, it's certainly a different series. I mean, that you were probably accustomed to. How did Piller convince you to come back for Deep Space Nine? Because this is a couple years later. And we're so glad you did.
Well, you know, we were pals. So, you know, there was no bump in our relationship, which is amazing to me, because if I had been Michael, I would, and I had like said sayonara to, you know, someone had said sayonara to me, I wouldn't have been that thrilled, to be honest, because it was someone, you know, on a show, if you have someone who you think you can do the job, you don't want to lose them, especially when you're offering them a lot of money and you're out, you know, it was a 2-year deal, which at the time was big, now 2-year deals are standard, but at the time, and it was a pay or play, they try to make it as attractive as possible for me to come back, but there was just no way. And so we still went to baseball games together and socialized. So at baseball games, he would just, you know, start bringing stuff up, like a little bit at a time, but, you know, there's going to be a new series, and then there's a Bible. Would I read the Bible? So I read the Bible. And he said, look, at Dodger Stadium, he said, look, this is going to be a different series. He used the words, it's going to reflect your sensibilities a lot more than TNG. It's going to be darker. There's going to be conflict. There's going to be, you know, humans and aliens and blah, blah, blah. I wasn't too thrilled when I saw there was a Ferengi, because I wasn't in love with the Ferengis, because I used had to use a Ferengi in the episode that I had to write for TNG, and even though it was Max, and Max is great, I just didn't like the idea. I didn't see them as threats. I didn't understand them. But I could see what he was talking about, and then we had another ball game that we went to, and he said, look, if you want to do – I said to him, if I come back to the show, I remember this so clear, I said, look, the first thing I would do, the first thing I'd say to you is I want to make a real friendship – between Amoros, which was the name of Bashir at the time, Dr. Amoros and O'Brien. These guys are so different on every level that I want them to become the first genuine friendship on Star Trek that has nothing to do with rank, or they're both, you know, in the same, they're both on the bridge together, so they're always working together. These guys never have to be in contact. One's a doctor, one's an engineer. They don't need to interact. And they don't even like each other at first, but they become best friends on the show. And Michael looked at me and said, well, why would you think I would have a problem with that? If that's what you think want to do, I would support that.
Wow.
So I said, okay. And he said, look, if you come back, I guarantee you after 2 seasons, I'm going to give you the show. And you'll run the show for the last 5 years. It'll be your show.
Wow.
And anyone else had said that to me, I would have thought they were not exactly being truthful.
Yeah, just selling you on something. Yeah, just trying to, yeah, it's Hollywood.
But because it was Michael, and Michael was an honorable man, I believed him.
Wow,
so I thought about it, and I, you know, I'm not, you know, it's funny, all these years later, we talk about it so cavalierly, but the TNG experience was very bad. I don't want to kid anyone.
Yeah.
I was not happy. I was miserable. I was disappointed as hell. You know, it was Star Trek. And I felt really bad. I felt really bad that I disliked my time on it that as much as I did. So, you know, the idea of going back and, you know, giving it a second chance. I was amazed that Rick said yes. I thought Rick would ding it, but we had lunch together in the commissary, you know, and he was very, you know, he didn't really put any obstacles in my way. He looked a little confused or that I was coming back. But
this is Rick Berman, who basically took over for Roddenberry. Yeah, basically ran the franchise after Roddenberry. But I think you had the same concerns that just about everybody else on Star Trek had, was that there was this vision of perfection in Roddenberry's universe, where for fans it's probably one thing, but as a writer, writers demand conflict, right? I mean, like, you need to write. That's how you write a script. You got to have conflict, right?
Yep.
So I think that that makes perfect sense with that offer. What were the so? And going into it, it broke the mold in so many ways, because you're talking about a serialized show where you watch The Next Generation. You could watch an episode, and at the end of the episode, you got a story. Deep Space Nine, you might have to go a whole season to get the whole story. You might have to go the whole run of the series to get the whole story. What were the challenges for you as a showrunner eventually, and as the writer, in just keeping track of all the different story arcs and the characters? Great for a writer, but how did you just keep it all together?
Well, that was simple. I mean, that was mother's milk. I mean, that wasn't the problem. It was getting there that was the problem. It was that first season where we were still leaning too heavily on, you know, even though it wasn't a bad episode, but bringing Q onto the show and Bosch back, and some of the other storytelling devices that we used felt like, who are we? What are we really doing? What's the goddamn gamma quadrant? What's so cool about this wormhole? The fact that we don't go anywhere, you know, how is that a strength? You know, I wish I had, you know, professors telling me, like they tell me now, that the promenade and the station was the inner city, you know, and it was a multicultural, you know, at the time we were told it was an airport waiting lounge, and, you know, it was a negative rather than a positive. So it was discovering the show and what worked about the show that was distinctly Deep Space Nine that no one else had. And, you know, the thing that really started getting my juices flowing was when Michael came, when we came back. I had 1 week off. We were supposed to have 2 weeks off, which is nothing. Usually you get 3 months off. We had 2 weeks off, and then Michael called me up and said, you got to come back. I said, I've only been gone a week. He goes, yeah, but we got to start right away on two. It's like, geez, I've just done all these episodes, and now we've got to come right back. Okay, came back, and he talked about doing a three-parter to open the series, the second season, which no one had done before. Wow. And this idea of no one had done before, I don't think Michael realized how much of an impact that was going to have on me. And this idea of a story going through a three-episode arc, because that's when I really started to see where the strengths of the show could be. And that's what excited me. And then all through season two, you know, the writers, Pete, Robert, and Jim and I, we'd go to lunch, and that's where we decided to come up with the Dominion, which would be villains that were not seen before. They were new villains just for Deep Space Nine. And because I wasn't confident at the time we could have a slam dunk villain on the first try, I said, we're going to come up with three different races of villains. Of course, one of them has to work. Even if two of them turn out to be like the Ferengi, one of them has to work. Little did we know that the whole thing would work.
More is better,
and
right?
And so it was during that second season that I started to get a real, you know, and by the second season, you know, it started to, you know, we started to get pushback from the studio and from other people saying, you know, stop thinking about serializing the show. These shows have to be standalone episodes. You're going to lose all your fans. People, if they miss an episode or they miss two episodes, they're not going to come back. You're destroying the show.
Well, it was syndicated too. So like they're thinking syndication, they might not air them in order, right?
Well, yeah, which is ridiculous, but okay, they won't air them in order. They also were airing them in some places at 3 o'clock in the morning. So if I have to worry about that, I won't come to work in the morning. You know, so it was like, what's the best for the series? What's going to make the show freaking good? And it was like, we, you know, it really got to the point where very soon where I, you know, we really didn't care. I didn't care who was watching, how many people were watching, if anyone was watching. That wasn't up to me. I didn't get any profit participation in this show. I was a gun for hire. I just wanted it to be good.
Did you approach it like just do it and then, you know, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness later if I have to?
Well, there were definitely some places where, you know, where you're going to have to stand your ground, yeah. You know. I mean, it took me 3 years to get them to agree to make Avery a captain. He never should have been a commander in the first place. It was too mature to be a commander. That, I don't think the fans liked. Plus, the beard, the shaving the head, that took 3 years. I don't even want to go into those fights. But you know, the best thing that happened to the show, without a doubt, I feel, was when Michael Piller came into the into my office looking very kind of serious and definitely had a weight on his shoulders, and he said, "Look, Ira, I just want you to know that I think you're doing a great job." This is after he had stepped down and kind of towards the end of season two. He goes, "I know you're doing a great job." This must have been in season three, I think. "I know you're doing a great job, and I love the show, but you know, Voyager is going to be premiering, and it's the flagship show of UPN, and you just have to understand that Deep Space Nine is never going to be the Star Trek show. It's always going to be number two. It was number two to TNG, and it's going to be number two to Voyager. So you just, you know, I'm sorry, but you know, you're always going to be in the shadow of another show." And he left like he just gave me a death sentence. And as soon as he left, it was like, "Yes, go, everyone go. Everyone look to Voyager. Give all your attention and all your time and all, everyone just go Voyage and leave us alone and we'll do what we want to do." And that's what happened.
All the notes from the studio were going to go to Voyager.
Everything was going there. I mean, it was like, yes, every now and then they would still bust my the serialization. There was a big battle about getting the Defiant. There was a big battle about the Dominion. There was a big battle about this, that, and the other.
That's why I was curious about, like, because they would say, like, "We need a ship on the show. It's Star Trek, and we need to, like, make Bashir more like Data." I talked about that with Alexander Siddig, you know, just like these weird things that, you know, like, make it more like Next Gen. You would kind of get those notes every now and again, right?
Yeah, but we were the ones asking for a ship. They weren't asking for the ship. Hated the idea. They hated the idea of the ship because the ship was Voyager. A ship was a starship. You know, yeah. It's like, "Look, guys, we came up with the Dominion, which you didn't ask us to do, but we did it anyway, and it's good for the show. But now we have the Dominion. We teased them out for an entire season. Who the hell is the Dominion? Now suddenly we're going to have the Dominion. We're going to have something coming through that wormhole. You know, and it's not going to be good. So what are we going to have to use against them? Runabouts? You can't even film on a runabout. The runabouts, the actors hated scenes in runabouts. They were so constricted. They were so tight, and they couldn't get camera people in there. The runabout, that's what we're going to use? No, we need a ship. We need a kick-ass, tough ship. We need a warship. Don't ever say the word war. Okay, no war. But we need a ship with weapons. I don't care. This is not a ship that's going to go exploring. This is a ship that's going to have to go gun to gun with the Dominion." And it's like, okay. And then it was like, okay, but it can't be a big ship. It's got to be a small ship. Okay, we accept it. It'll be a small ship. And it can't be that cool. Well, you decide what you think is cool. We'll decide what we think is cool. And we'll see what happens. So basically, we got the exact kind of ship we wanted. And we had, you know, it didn't change the show in terms of it was still a show that was based on, you know, a continuing story. It was still what was happening on that station. But at least now, you know, we could go find out what's in the Gamma Quadrant, for God's sake, and we could deal with it. You know, it was between the Dominion and religion, you know, the Bajoran religion, you know, we had a very different show.
Just so you can gloat now, I will let you know I have a Defiant toy. I do not have a Voyager toy.
Well, there's no gloating involved.
I'm just giving you a little information. You can do with it as you please. I talked about the episode duet with Nana Visitor. Man, what could have been an instantly forgettable episode turned into one of the series' most memorable episodes. I mean, it's like it plays out like a stage play. It's unbelievable. Yeah. You guys just broke so many, like, just, is that one of the ones you wanted to sink your teeth into? Shows like that, where it's just like these small little character-driven pieces?
Yeah, well, that show had a wacky development of which, you know, the details are all in, I'm sure, the DS9 Companion by Terry Erdman. But there were two writers who were, who we brought on as freelance writers, and they took a pass at a story, but it wasn't really right. Then Pete Fields came in and he really shaped it into a story that worked. But it was the end of the year and everyone was kind of burning rubber at that point. And the show wasn't the script wasn't quite getting there. So Pete, I went into Pete's office for a couple of days and we did a rewrite together. And I would pace up and down. He'd be by the computer and I'd be pacing up and down, raving like a freaking maniac as the Harris Yulin character, just going on saying the most incredibly nasty, you know, vicious, warmongering, hateful things, you know, and then he'd write it all down and then we just start crafting it into these speeches that we did. So I had a hell of a, we laughed our asses off while we were doing that because it was just crazy. I mean, we were afraid they were going to send security up to the office in the building because I was just shouting out like all about blood and death and killing and purity and cleansing and this, that, and the other thing. So, It was a lot of fun doing that show with you know, in that way. I mean, it was Pete's script, but I got to put, you know, have some fun with it in those whatever we call those prison cell scenes, holding cell scenes. So that was a good show. And then of course I got called down to the set. The first time I got called down to the set, because you know, I wasn't running the show by any means at that point. It was all Michael, but for some reason, I guess because I was working on that episode, I got called down to Harris Yulin's trailer, and he told me that the show was an absolute piece of dreck, and he wanted a major rewrite, and that we had to make the character more likable. And it was the first time I ever had to really deal with a recalcitrant actor. Wow. I mean, I did it on Fame a bunch of times, but they were kids mostly.
Yeah.
But this was a guy who I respected who was just telling me that the show was terrible. And it was like, I don't think so. You know, I mean, this show went through so many permutations and so many different things. When we finally landed on this kind of works. He goes, no, they got to understand me. They have to understand. I think they're going to understand, you know. I think they'll get it. We don't have to tell it to them. So that was a weird moment. That was a classic memory. Wow. of season one for me. He was being trapped in this trailer with this guy who was just...
How did you convince him?
I didn't have to convince him, right. Ultimately. Right. It was like I had to listen to him.
Yeah,
and I did listen to him. But the bottom line is we're not going to change the script.
Yeah,
you know.
He probably just wanted to be heard. That's a lot of actors. Yeah. They just want to be heard.
Yep.
So. Trials and Tribulations, was that your sort of homage to sitting there in front of the TV set with your sister enjoying Star Trek Classic?
Well, not really, because at the time, being the little nasty people that we could be, when Rick called me up and said, okay, we're doing this this 30-year celebration, I said, what's so cool about being 30? It's like, that says we're old and what the hell?
Says the man who's 25 now.
You know, so it's like, you know, what does that have to do with Deep Space Nine? He said, well, Voyager's doing something. And I said, good, let Voyager do it. We don't have to do it. And of course, then I went back to the writer's room and we started talking. Suddenly we got excited about all the different kind of, I wanted to do Charlie X. Someone else wanted to do the gangster one, the one where they go on the planet, which is like 1930s gangster.
Yeah, Piece of the Action.
Anyway, yeah, the Piece of the Action, exactly. But finally, we wound up, Renee and Ron, they keep giving each other, like, kudos for who actually came up with it. But it was came up with Tribbles and then the idea of doing it like a Zelig, where we'd mix the two time frames together and have our cast interacting with the older cast. And it became a crazy time at Paramount. I mean, talk about people having too much fun, except for the actors. The actors could still grumble like actors always do because they're in makeup in the hours. But everyone else, the art department, the writers, everyone was just, it was like 2 weeks. I say, it's like trying to herd cats. It's like, guys, we still have to work again. The season doesn't end. I remember saying this. The season doesn't end with Trials and Tribulations. We've got a whole rest of the series to the season to break. We've got to sit in the freaking room and come up with ideas and write episodes. We can't be down at the set all the time. We're talking about the set.
What a playground.
Or going through dailies three times. It's like, it's good. It's fun. But we got to work. You know, I was like the bad.
You're the boss.
You know. Yeah,
you're the boss. You're the parent. Yeah, I know. But what a playground, man! That look—that's a once in a lifetime, man.
It definitely was, and it worked like gangbusters, you know. And I talked recently to Jonathan West about it, and who directed the episode. I interviewed him for the documentary. I said, Jonathan, how the hell did you get the assignment to direct that episode? That was a really expensive, the most expensive episode we ever did. And how did you get, how did you wind up directing that episode? And he looked at me and goes, you asked me. And I said, oh, well, yes, that's right. That is how you did it. You're absolutely right.
Oh.
But who remembered at that point?
The show has taken on a new life. I mean, it's really found a whole new audience. If someone hasn't heard of Deep Space Nine, and I can't imagine, but, you know, maybe a younger listener, somebody coming in, oh, I'm seeing Discovery, you know, what else is out there? What three episodes would you start them off with and why?
Wow. You know, those are easy questions to ask, but they're not easy to answer.
Which three of your children are your favorites?
Yeah, I don't think I have an answer to that.
It's an unfair question. I would guess you'd probably maybe pick Past Tense Parts 1 and 2.
I don't know. I mean, I'm very proud of those episodes, but, you know, it's like, you know, look, times have changed. At the time, when we were doing stuff like Past Tense and Far Beyond the Stars, I always felt, believe it or not, that those were episodes that were too easy. That's what you expect. You expect a nice, strong social statement from Star Trek where you're preaching basically to people who already believe what you're saying. And everyone pats themselves on the back and go, okay, we are decent people giving a decent message. And to me, that felt easy, shooting ducks in a barrel. So, you know, but I've changed. The world has changed me over the years. And as we keep fighting the same battles and as we're still fighting racism and hatred and all these things just don't go away. They always are there underneath the surface, both around this globe that we live on in every country or many countries, but this America, I love it, but there is some problems from the beginning that have not gone away. And, you know, we have our heads up our ass on a lot of things. And so I look back at those episodes and go, yeah, you know what? Screw it. You do need to keep telling people, even if you are saying the expected or maybe you're not convincing anyone, but maybe you're telling people who believe in it to be stronger in their beliefs. So I'm much fonder of those episodes now than I was when we were making them. I feel they're more important than I thought then. But, like, you know, I also love something like His Way, where you did something so far off the, you know, a romance between Odo and Kira with a Las Vegas lounge singer. It just showed what the show had many different facets to
You're
it.
Big on your lounge singer. Yeah, you are.
We're carving our own path.
It's a fun show. Look, it's a fun show. It goes so many. It's so layered. I can't. I'm enjoying reliving it. I mean, it's on Netflix. It's on CBS streaming. We need you back in the world of Star Trek. Any interest? Yes.
To be frank, I don't think there's any interest in me. Or most of us who are involved. I know Brian got to do had a shot, but even that was, I guess, a rocky road. You know, I did forget about the 1 year on TNG, which was, you know, that's something, even if it didn't work out the way I wanted. But I had 7 years actually. You know, when I started on the show.
By the way, don't diminish your time on TNG, because you got yesterday's Enterprise out of that too. So,
finish your thought,
but I do want to say probably my favorite episode of The Next Generation. Please continue, my friend.
it doesn't matter. It's all just words.
No, but you're saying you got.
Look,
but you're...
It was 7 great years. It was 7 great years. I really enjoyed my time, even though at the time my wife will tell you, you know, some of these battles drove me mental, you know, the fighting that we didn't have to fight, the idea that we couldn't blow off both of Nog's legs because that's too nasty. It's like they have all this technology. Everyone knows at the end of the episode he's getting his legs back. But blowing off both his legs makes him half a man, half a human being. There's just something sadder, creepier, more unsettling about it. It's all going to have a happy ending. Everyone knows it's going to have a happy ending. But let's just see if we can't make them a little uncomfortable, a little more uncomfortable. No, absolutely not. It's too grim. One leg is enough. And I'm having an argument about blowing up a character's legs.
Which they just did on the Orville.
It's so dumb.
They just did that on the Orville. Yeah, I know.
What? A waste of time, a waste of energy, a waste of everything. Well, but anyway.
Well, no, Tarantino's supposed to come in and do a Trek film. There's Discovery, and they're doing all kinds of dark things. I mean, are you looking into that, or you're done with Trek? Let's focus.
I don't know if I'm done with Trek, but I'm not looking. You know, I'm not really living it. I didn't think we were. The thing people forget that I really hope this documentary will really drive home again, even if it has to be repeated and seen every 10 years, is that as dark as Deep Space was, and it was darker than the other shows, it was also the most family oriented. It had the best friendships. It was a very positive show. You know, the whether it's Jadzia and Worf, Bashir and Garrick, Bashir and O'Brien, Odo and Quark, Cassidy Yates and Sisko and Jake, Jake and Nog, I mean, Rom and Quark, Rom and Lita. I mean, it's all about relationships. It's all about the family. It's all about love and coming together in the darkest of times. So I don't buy. Discovery is a dark show. Well, maybe I'm sure it is, and it's easy to be a dark show in 2018. Try and be a dark Star Trek show in 1997 and see where it gets you. It gets you people who think you're an also-ran. You're second best, third best, fourth best. You know, you're a mistake, basically. You're the show that they forgot to give you a starship. And that's all good. That's all good, because if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have been able to do the show on the low down like we did it. And
You said at the time, this is a show that will not be appreciated in its time. Give it time.
Yeah.
Are you finding that you're going to conventions, you're meeting and greeting, you're getting the input, you're getting the feedback. Are you finding that it's now being appreciated? I will give you my opinion real quick. I think it's the one Star Trek that stands the test of time.
I did get a call, like in 2014, I think it was, from Avery Brooks, and I never heard him quite sound so happy, like legitimately, like pleased. And he said, "These Star Trek conventions, have you noticed the fans? They're so young, they're so new, they're so passionate. They're not caught up in the old stuff about, you know, Gene Roddenberry's universe and who, is it a real Star Trek series? Is it not? Is it true? Is it this?" They just like it. They just like it. And they're new and they like what they like, and they don't, that's all they care about. And I said, "Yeah, I'm feeling it loud and clear. It's a beautiful thing." And the fans, you know, I like the fans, obviously, fans who had watched it, didn't like it, tried to watch it, didn't like it. And now, thanks to streaming and all that stuff, they get it. But you know what? It's less about that, really, at this stage. You know, I'm thankful for it. It's nice. I realize it has nothing to do with the show. The show has not changed one iota since it was made. It's just the delivery system has changed and how people watch television has changed. So I don't think we have to take so much credit, because it's just how the world has changed.
I was going to say, have we changed? But we've changed.
Yeah, I guess the viewer has changed, but that's okay. But that's not what I take away from the show. You know, I've forgotten about that quite a while back. You know, what I take away from the show is something very different, which is, you know, when I'm an audience member, when there's something I like, if I like Peaky Blinders, the TV show, or if I like the Venture Brothers, or I like the Lord of the Rings movies, I'm not thinking about the filmmakers while they're making it, what they felt and what they went through and how they feel about it now and how, you know, this, that, or the other thing. It's like, do I like it? Does it work for me? Blah, blah, blah. Because I'm not on the bus. I'm watching the bus. But when you're on the bus, it's all about being on the bus. It's all about the process, all about the journey, as they say, not the destination. So it's the fact that I have so many friends and so many people I care about who were involved with the show, that I have so many good memories about the show, that, you know, the feeling that it was at times it felt like a war, and you had to fight for the right to push that envelope when no one wanted us to push the envelope. No one was interested in us pushing the envelope. You know, it was like we did it anyway because we felt it was right. That is what I really think about when I think about Deep Space Nine. I don't think about, you know, whether it's more popular now. That's nice to know, but I felt this, you know, back in 2010 or 2006 or whatever year you want to say, when, you know, we were, you know, forgotten, or we were bubbling under the surface or whatever you want to say. My Deep Space Nine experience is a different Deep Space Nine experience than a fan experience. And that's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, it's working for a whole new generation of fans now, because you guys did something really special 25 years ago. Man, it's amazing. When are we seeing this documentary? When can we find out about it, and websites, Twitter, all that good stuff? When can we see all this?
Well, WeLeftBehind.com, I believe. But the goal is to have the doc out and about for viewing by the fall. That's what I would predict.
Oh, wow. Okay. Because I know you're originally shooting for the 25th anniversary, but you guys have a lot more to work with now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I never shot for anything. You know, what I told these guys from the start was, it'll be done when it's done, when I think it's ready to be finished. You know, and the fact is that once we started, look, this is all because, you know, this is all the Indiegogo campaign. It was like, okay, the fans want something special. We have to give them something special. We have to give them a show. This has to be an outlier documentary, just like the show was an outlier to the franchise. This should not feel like any other documentary about Star Trek. And it's got to have its own voice. And we're interviewing everyone, we're talking, we're doing the writer's room, we're doing all these things, and we're doing some other stuff that I'm having, you know, that we filmed and going to be filming that's kind of interesting and different. And so that's all I care about. You know, everyone keeps saying, well, we said this, we said that, and I go, I never said any of it. I don't care. It's a documentary, for Christ's sake, you know? Who cares about a documentary? We'll do it because we want to do it, and we'll do it until it's done.
I love me some Ira Bear, man. I love me some Ira Bear. You are a character, my friend. DS9documentary.com, that's where we can find it. It's your anniversary, but we're getting the gift, man, and we appreciate it.
Oh, that's nice to say. I like it. That was sweet. That's a good way of putting it.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us 7 seasons of this incredible show. Thank you for the upcoming documentary. We are so stoked for this. Social media, how can we get inside the mind of Ira Stephen Bear?
Huh?
Social media.
Would you want to go there? Aren't we enough people's goddamn minds? Can't we leave our minds alone, for Christ's sake? I don't want anyone in my mind. Social media is I don't want to get into social media. Boy, I've had a hard time not saying naughty words throughout this whole
yes,
thing.
Yes, I appreciate that.
You know, I'll just say I am on Twitter because Dave Sapone said I had to be on Twitter. So I am on Twitter. And
but don't follow you there, right?
And you can twit me if you want. That's about my social media presence. And I thank all my followers for following me. I'm sure they follow everyone else as well. So maybe I don't thank them because that's what everyone does. We all follow each other. But where are we going, Joe? We're all following each other, but where are we going?
In the wormhole. We're going in the wormhole.
Yeah, that's a good answer, Joe, actually. You're brighter than you let on at times.
Sometimes, hey, blind squirrel can find a nut, right? Ira, happy again. Happy 25th. Looking forward to the documentary. Looking forward to whatever you got coming at us. Thank you so much.
Keep looking. Go watch Lucky. Go watch my film Lucky that I produced last year. You want to do something. Go watch Lucky with Harry Dean Stanton and David Lynch.
Oh, Harry Dean Stanton. Where can we see it? Is it on Netflix?
It's now on DVD. It's going to be on... It's going to be on Hulu soon. It's going to be streaming right now. It's a great film with very
the great
small
Harry Dean
indie
Stanton.
Film. Great film.
We will go watch that. We're going to watch everything you produce. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks, Joe. Take care.
You can follow Ira Stephen Bear into the wormhole and wherever else he wants to take you on Twitter. It's at Ira Stephen Bear. And you can pre-order the DS9 documentary, What We Left Behind, at ds9documentary.com. My thanks to Ira for stopping by today to celebrate the 25th anniversary of this amazing show. It is so incredible, and you can catch it now on Netflix and CBS All Access. So if you haven't seen it, or if you haven't seen it in a long, long time, go check it out. It's fun going back and revisiting Star Trek Deep Space Nine. All right, time to check out the Comic Book Central mailbag. This week I heard from Lynn Workman. As you might recall, Lynn gave us that incredible sketch cover for the anniversary show giveaway. Well, Lynn wrote in and he says, "Hey Joe, just listened to episode 201 and your interview with Walter Koenig. Really enjoyed it. I saw him at the 2005 San Diego Comic-Con, but I've never actually got to meet him. I got a bit teary when he was talking about his son as a baby while he was writing. Then later, while talking about Anton Yelchin's death, and he mentioned how hard it was when your child passes before you. So sorry that he had to go through that with his son and Anton. I've been back in the Batcave working on a few new sketch covers since my bypass surgery in mid-November. Yep, I took some time off too, but it was not a staycation I recommend, although the hospital food wasn't too bad. It's been nice to be able to get back to the drawing board in my studio again when I'm not on my day job. Did a John Wesley Ship Earth 3 Flash cover and a Groot one. And this week I asked my wife what I should draw next. She left for a second and then came back and dropped a blank Supergirl sketch cover in my lap. So I'm now working on a Melissa Benoist one for her. She is a big fan of the show and is looking forward to it coming back on the CW soon. I enjoyed Justice League. Not my favorite WBDC movie, but it was a good popcorn movie. Guy was great as always, and I do hope we get at least one more Batfleck movie. Going to listen to your Joe Morton episode next. Yeah, I'm jumping around a bit, but that's one of the good things about Comic Book Central. You can listen in whatever order you want. Congrats on the new team up with Blog Talk Radio, and look forward to the website updates. Hope it all helps you share the lair more. Hey, thanks for writing in, Lynn. Always appreciate when you share the lair, and so glad to hear you are feeling better and back at work, back at the drawing table, bringing us a lot more fantastic artwork of those actors bringing comic book characters to life. We love it. So I'll put a link to your blog up there. We can watch the progress as you are putting, I know you're putting all the pictures out there as you're drawing them. So always fun to watch that as well. I also heard from Scott Doran. Scott wrote in and he said, like you, Joe, I'm a big fan of Superman as well. And the 1978 Superman movie is my all-time favorite. In fact, I received an awesome Christmas gift, the extended cut 3-hour version of Superman on Blu-ray. Of course, there's a celebration of Superman coming up in Metropolis, Illinois. It's also the 40th anniversary of the movie. Can't wait to hear what guests you have in store for this super year. Until then, look up in the sky. Hey, thanks, Scott. Appreciate you writing in as well. Yes, I do have that Blu-ray version of the extended cut. I haven't had a chance to check it out yet, but soon, very, very soon. I think that's the first official version of that film. I mean, we've seen all the extras, the deleted scenes and things like that. What was it, 45 minutes extra footage? I think we've seen it in bits and pieces, but I think this is the first official version of this since it aired on ABC way back in the day. So I'm looking forward to seeing that in Blu-ray. That's going to be awesome as well. Always a great celebration every year in Metropolis, Illinois. Super show, super guests. I've been there several times. I'm hoping to make it back again this year. We'll see if that happens. 80th anniversary of Superman, 40th for the movie, like you said, so hopefully I'll be able to make it back there and record some content for the show. And I do have another Superman-themed surprise coming up as I am planning to take the show on the road once again. So hopefully to Metropolis, Illinois, but another super surprise coming up. More on that very soon. Stay tuned. And if you want more super guests, you're going to get them this year. And just stand by because in just a few minutes, you're going to love what I have to say. But first, I want to remind everybody out there, drop me a line like Lynn and Scott did. Send an email to joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website. If you've got some super guests in mind, throw them my way. We'll see if we can get them on the show. The website, comicbookcentral.net. You can click that Signal Me tab there, and be sure to follow the show on social media. The links are there as well for Facebook and Twitter, and share the lair on social media just like Lynn and Scott and so many of you out there do. I always appreciate that. All right, that is all the time we have for today. I think I'm going to go hang out at Quark's Bar, maybe meet up with Ira, knock back a few Warp Core Breach drinks. We'll see. But don't worry, I'll be in good shape for next week's show. Another cool conversation, because next week on Comic Book Central, you want super guests? This is the place to be. From the hit CW show Supergirl, I will be meeting up with a member of the Luthor family. That's right, Lex and Lena Luthor's mom, Lillian Luthor, actress Brenda Strong. She's going to be stopped by to chat about the world of Supergirl, Superman, some more Star Trek talk. I promise that's going to happen. And yes, we're even going to talk about Spaceballs. That is what's headed your way next week. Until then, watch those wormholes, keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivations 3.0 Imported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Embrace me, my sweet embraceable you. Embrace me, you irreplaceable you. Just one
good afternoon,
look at
ma'am.
You, my heart goes...
Ma'am?
Oh! Hey, don't touch me!
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to startle you. I just thought it was time I got to know my new neighbors.
Who the hell are you?
I'm Captain Justice, here in this dimension to protect the innocent from the wanton perpetrators of felonious crimes.
Not on my lawn, you're not.
Ma'am...
Hey, Cappy. Some guys might mention the fact that you're soaked from head to toe. Not me. I figure a guy walks around looking ridiculous, he's got his reasons.
Thanks.